Miami-Dade's mayor contracts COVID, and the busiest storm season on record is in the books. Hello, and welcome to this Pledge Drive edition of Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava just started the job last week and is now self-isolating at home. What's the county's plan for tackling the virus? Plus,
it was an extremely active season. We did break the record for most named storms in a single Atlantic hurricane season prior to 2020.
South Florida was mostly spared from the damage of the record number of storms this year. But climate change means we could be seeing even more intense storms in the years to come. Finally, a new service in our region that connects seniors in isolation with young people. We introduce you to Grandkids on Demand. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. And thank you for your support during this first day of our winter membership campaign. Coronavirus cases continue to spike nationwide, and political leadership in South Florida has not been safe from the virus. Yesterday, Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava tweeted that she has tested positive for the virus and is now self-isolating at home. Her announcement came just days after her predecessor, now Congressman-elect Carlos Jimenez, announced he had tested positive for the virus. Both Cava and Jimenez are displaying mild symptoms and are continuing to work from home. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald. You had the opportunity to speak with her last night, right? How does she sound on the phone and what did she tell you?
She sounded like she had a mild cold. She was a little congested. And she said that she was feeling okay, that she had had a full day of work. And at least through part of that, she would have known she had COVID-19 and probably suspected she did throughout the day. But she had virtual meetings with staff, with the NAACP over some complaints about one of her hires. She attended a Haitian American group meeting. So a fairly typical day, but all online, all virtual.
And do we have a sense of where the mayor might have contracted the virus?
Well, they're very definitive, her office and herself. Her husband is a doctor and made a house call Wednesday evening, to a patient. And that patient later tested positive for COVID-19. Don't know when that patient tested positive, but when they started feeling sick Sunday, they got the results Monday, and they've decided we're very confident it came from that patient who exposed Dr. Cava, who then exposed his wife.
And this revelation that the mayor has tested positive comes just a few days after her predecessor and now Congressman-elect Carlos Jimenez tested positive. Do we know the status of how former Mayor Jimenez is doing?
No, I've learned more since his original announcement Friday, saying that he had mild symptoms. So sounds like they're fairly similar.
And Mayor Levine-Cava, will she continue to work through the illness? Like, I know that there's a county commission meeting happening today that you're covering, correct?
Correct. Yeah, she said she'll continue to work. She'll be participating with the meeting today on the phone or by video, depending on what they set up. And she's planning on a 10-day isolation. That's the CDC guideline. If your symptoms are mild, they don't recommend a testing-based return, meaning that you might continue to test positive, but you can still go back and mingle with the public with the appropriate masking, et cetera.
And this is a mayor who campaigned on taking a very serious approach in fighting the coronavirus. She hired a chief medical officer for the county for the first time and was often really critical of her predecessor for not taking a hardline enough approach in combating the spread of the coronavirus and stopping the spread in its tracks. Does this in any way hurt her credibility at all, politically speaking? And I mention that because just prior to the election, she attended an event with Miami Beach City Commissioner David Richardson, who also tested positive. And then now she herself has tested positive.
Right. So in that incident with Richardson, it did look like people were wearing masks. I mean, the thing is, wearing a mask does not spare you from having to isolate or quarantine if someone around you is test positive, it seems. In her comments after her testing positive, she really emphasized, you know, like thousands of other families with healthcare workers, we have higher vulnerability and higher exposure. So the idea being that this is a risk that's kind of unavoidable, I guess, if you're in the healthcare field. We don't know the circumstances of what happened there with the patient and what steps were taken. She said that Dr. Kyler was taking all the appropriate precautions in treating the patient as if the person had COVID, but the person at that point had not been diagnosed with COVID. He was seeing the patient for some other reason.
Right. And we know that healthcare workers are one of the top professions that at risk of contracting the virus through their work or otherwise. And what have we heard so far from the Levine-Cava administration about the actions being taken just since she came into office to reduce the spread of the coronavirus?
Well, they haven't changed anything that I'm aware of. She named a chief medical officer, but he continues to work at Jackson. And she extended all the Jimenez orders and has a very similar message to the public regarding masking and social distancing for Thanksgiving.
And there's a vote today at the county commission meeting that would seek to make permanent the changes to outdoor dining that were implemented early on in the pandemic. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, this would do two things. One, it would essentially legalize dining areas in parking lots. I think the impression would be a green light for a lot of parking lot dining rooms, but it would still be part of the code under, you know, you can imagine 20 different rules. But if everything works out and you have extra parking spaces, you could convert that to dining area. Now, there's a second, less permanent change as proposed that would allow tables on sidewalks and tables in little parking spots in front of your restaurant through 2022.
We're seeing numbers continue to rise rapidly across the country, though the spread isn't quite as fast here in South Florida. Do we have any idea of any changes that might be coming in the coming weeks because of the expected uptick because of Thanksgiving gatherings? Like, has the administration suggested that they're willing to implement any more restrictions that are not in place right now? Like maybe go back to some of the things we saw in April and March this year?
Well, they're very limited at what they can do because of a statewide order by Governor DeSantis, which restricts local government's ability to close. Well, they can't close businesses. They can't cut down on dining room capacity, which was the major step they did in July. They could roll back the curfew, but that's problematic even within Miami-Dade County. Miami's not enforcing the curfew, and it's the county survived the legal challenge of the curfew, but it's certainly on shaky ground. They lost at the trial level. So I think the theme for Levine-Cava is she is hampered more than Jimenez was the last time the cases were rising like they are now, which was June into July. July is when it really hit the crisis mode.
And a lot of that, those restrictions are because of the orders that have come down from the DeSantis administration. Do we have an idea just yet of what the relationship will be between Mayor Levine-Cava and the DeSantis administration?
The tea leaves suggest not good because she keeps saying, I can't get him on the phone. So we'll see. But, you know, the relationship between DeSantis and Jimenez was not good in the beginning. They did warm up during COVID. But now, obviously, DeSantis, leader of the Republican Party, Levine-Cava, top Democrat in Florida, given her position, there's going to be friction, even like in public. It doesn't seem to be the, we're all working together. Like, we have not seen that yet. And from what you hear from her, she says that she's been eager to talk to him and has been unable to. Maybe that's changed in the last 48 hours or so. I'll check, but not a good sign.
That was Miami Herald reporter Doug Hanks. You can find more of his coverage on COVID-19 in Miami-Dade County and the results of today's commission meeting vote on outdoor dining by going to WLRN.org. Still to come, the 2020 hurricane season is now in the books, and it was the busiest season on record. But first, in order to continue conversations like this one, we need a staff of reporters, producers, and engineers. And that doesn't happen for free. It comes with your support. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A reminder, this is our winter membership campaign, and we need your support to continue programs like this one. It's December 1st, which means another hurricane season is now in the books. South Florida was largely spared from the brunt of the storms this year, but it was the busiest storm season in our history. The record storms also brought extensive rain to our region, which had devastating impact on crops. Agriculture in South Florida was already struggling because of the pandemic. WLRN's environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich joined me earlier today to talk about this year's season. Jenny, you've been tracking storms in South Florida for years now at WLRN and the Miami Herald. How does the 2020 season compare to past years in terms of the sheer number of named storms?
So 2020 goes down as a now the busiest season on record. There were 31 tropical cyclones, 30 became tropical storms, named tropical storms. That's the highest that we've ever had on record. And so not only did we have a high number of tropical storms, we also had a high number of hurricanes. There were 13 hurricanes, although 2005, which I think most South Floridians will remember as a really busy year, still holds the record with 15 hurricanes.
And do we have an idea what may have caused this storm season to be so historically busy compared to past years?
Well, we knew going into the season that the Atlantic was really warm. The waters in the Gulf of Mexico were really warm. And so all that warm water really feeds storms. It was forecast to be an above average storm. This would have been the fifth consecutive year for an above average hurricane season in the Atlantic. By September, we had 28 storms. That's a huge number of storms that early in the season. Remember, the season generally peaks in mid-August. The mid-August to beginning of September is when the season peaks, and we already had 28 storms by then.
And the season just ended. What's the likelihood that we could still get any creeper storms creeping in past the deadline of November 30th?
Well, there's actually like a system out there they're watching now. They have occurred before in the past. We are still having a La Nina, which is why the end of the season got so busy. La Nina weather patterns I don't want to say encourage hurricanes, but they don't prevent hurricanes or tamp them down like El Nino conditions do. There's no wind shear that kind of shreds the hurricanes. And that's why, again, the end of the season got so busy. And when Eta hit, it was one of these rapidly intensifying hurricanes that can be really dangerous because they can't really forecast. The hurricane forecasters at the National Hurricane Center still struggle to forecast those rapidly intensifying hurricanes. And that's when a hurricane increases in wind speed by about 35 miles an hour within 24 hours. And we had 10 of those this year.
You recently talked to Colorado State hurricane scientist Phil Klotzbach. Let's take a listen to what he said.
If you look basically kind of at the model simulations and everything of what we expect to see in the future, we don't necessarily expect to see more overall storms. So the fact we got 30 storms this year doesn't necessarily mean that's the quote unquote new normal. One of the reasons why we're seeing these elevated numbers of overall storms is due to the fact we have improved observations. We have higher resolution satellite imagery, things like that, that help identify some of these weak storms that are tropical cyclones, but they would have likely been missed even say prior to the mid-1990s. And this year we had 8 of those. So 8 of the 30 storms were 2 days or fewer. But with that being said, so maybe the number of storms, not necessarily much of a tie to climate change. The overall intensity of storms is likely to get a little bit stronger in the future with climate change.
Can you tell us about this technology that captures storms that you've reported on in the past?
Right. So the satellite system has improved dramatically. I mean, that's part of the reason why we see so many storms now or record them is because we can track them better because we have better satellites. And in about 2016, the GOES East satellite was launched. That kind of hovers. It's a geostationary satellite. For satellite nerds like me, it means it kind of rotates with the Earth. And it can take images five times faster than the previous storm. So they're just getting a lot more data than they used to. That's improved the hurricane track forecasting and narrowed the cone. So we get a lot more accurate track forecasts now.
So that's better for us on the waiting end, right? If we're looking at something in the middle of the Atlantic and trying to make plans, that's the technology's incrementally getting better for us to do our planning, I suppose.
Right. So that narrower cone means that if you're, in South Florida, which is a peninsula that sticks out in the middle of the water, if it's a narrower cone, then, you know, you can plan better. You know, the cone used to cover a bigger area. So if it was rolling towards Florida, you would be in the cone. Now you're less likely because of the improved forecast or track forecast.
So Klotzbach believes it's not necessarily the number of storms that's going to change because of climate change, but the intensity. Can you tell us a little bit about the factors that can contribute to a storm's intensity?
The rapid intensification is something that climate change definitely is having an impact on. We have a wetter atmosphere. That means there's more rain and storms. That means the impacts that we feel, wind and rain, are going to be worse as the planet warms up. I mentioned the rapid intensification storms. The Washington Post reported recently that the chances for a storm rapidly intensify in the 1980s was like 1 in 100, and now we have a 1 in 20% chance, and hurricane researchers say rapid intensification is definitely something that has climate change fingerprints on it.
And this has also been a record season, not just for the named storms, but in the amount of rain that we've actually seen here on the Florida Peninsula. And that's had a devastating impact on agriculture here in South Florida. You recently spoke with Sam Accursio, a second-generation farmer in Homestead. Paint us a picture about what he saw this season happen to his crops because of the rain.
So Sam told me that this is the first time in 40 years of farming where he has never had to water his crops. He said there was so much rain and the groundwater table was so high that he was planting, fertilizing everything in water, and that lowered production. He said he was not able to meet his Thanksgiving and Christmas, he said, are the two biggest times of the year. He wasn't able to meet the Thanksgiving supply. And when I talked to him last week, he did not think that he was going to meet the Christmas supply either. And during this season, he grows beans and pickling cucumbers and squash. And pickling cucumbers and squash, he said, there's no crop insurance that you can purchase for those.
And how have farmers like Sam and other farmers responded to the record amount of water that they've received? Like, are there mitigation systems to lessen the damage to the fields or to the crops?
Well, they rely on the Water Management District and the Army Corps to run the flood control system, basically. And, you know, it is a complicated system. Sam believes that you could drain the fields quickly if you opened up and operated a pump that runs into Barnes Sound. Sorry, this is a little in the weeds, but there are environmental conditions that, you know, you could do damage by doing that. You don't want to flush that much fresh water. So there's, you know, it's a balancing act.
You know, when we talk about increased rain events and its impact on agriculture statewide is one of the main industries in Florida. Have state leaders been preparing for this kind of increased rainfall and the impact it might have on the crops that we grow here?
Well, I think that's part of the Everglades Restoration Program, right, is to figure out the flow of water. They want to put more water in the park. Part of that plan is balancing the water that's in developed areas versus the park. And they are now looking at systems, whether it's a some kind of seepage wall, a curtain wall that they would put underground to prevent the water from flowing into the ag land. They've already dug some pumps and tried to pump the water out of the ag land and back into the canal to run it into the park. But that is a complicated fix. There are other impacts from climate change that have to do with temperature. And, you know, I think we've talked about this before. So crops are migrating north as it gets warmer.
That was WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. You can read more of Jenny's reporting on this year's record storm season and its impact on crops by going to WLRN.org. Still to come, we introduce you to Grandkids on Demand, a new service connecting young people with seniors in isolation. But first, I have to ask you, do you listen to WLRN every day? Has Morning Edition become an essential start to your day, just like a morning coffee? If so, take a moment and support the news you depend on. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during our winter membership campaign. A local Grandkids on Demand startup called Papa is helping older adults get through the pandemic by pairing them with young adults, who are known as Papa Pals. They provide companionship and assistance on everyday tasks, which have become more taxing with COVID-19 restrictions, especially for those of a certain age. 81-year-old Rosaline Eline lives in Pennsylvania. Papa paired her with 20-year-old Cheyenne Harleman, who lost her job as a hairstylist because of the shutdowns related to the pandemic. Since then, she's become a full-time Papa Pal. They spoke with Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle about how they've bonded throughout this time.
Well, the first couple of months we were really confined to our home and people couldn't come. So, you know, sometimes I'd just leave groceries on my porch and that type of thing. Nobody came in the house. We're a little bit less rigid right now, but we're still trying to be careful. But it was getting groceries in and that sort of thing. That was getting difficult. Just all kinds of things sometimes. And I have trouble like using the vacuum cleaner. I use a small one every couple of days, but the one that, you know, I can't push that. I only have one arm. See, 9 years ago, I had a carotid artery operated on that gave me a stroke. So for a one-day surgery, I ended up being in the hospital for 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I learned to sit, I had to learn to walk, I had to learn to do everything all over again. A lot of things I can do. I'm very blessed.
Yes. I mean, like, I know she has family that comes around, but, you know, they have lives too. And I mean, I do too, but I mean, this is my job. Like, and I don't even really consider it a job. This is like, they're friends to me, you know? They're human beings just as much as I am, you know? The only difference is they live longer than me. And, you know, it's like, it feels good when I can get them out of the house and when I can make them laugh and when, you know, it's a good feeling. It's not like, oh my gosh, I have to go to her house and help her clean her house and all this. It's like, I enjoy helping her, like, because I know she struggles and I know one day I'll get there too and I'll need somebody too. So, you know, whatever I can do to help.
I worked for 22 years at a drug and alcohol agency, and then the next 10 years I worked for a mental health facility. They were stressful, but I really loved my jobs. I hated to quit. I worked till I was 70, so I you can tell I kind of like my work.
Yes.
Well, I think everybody's experiencing some either depression or sadness. So, you know, this whole thing has really affected most people, even children. Mm-hmm. But I've always found stuff to be funny in my life. I've always looked for humor. I mean, and when I work with my, we called them consumers back then, they don't call them that anymore. But when I work with my consumers, I always try to tell them, look for something positive every day, you know. And when you wake up, you know, I always thank God for the good stuff because we all talk about the bad stuff. You know, we can constantly be talking about this pandemic, but there's so many good things in this world, you know, and good people. So I enjoy life. I mean, one arm or not, I have fun. I really do. I never know when tomorrow is going to be my last day. So I try to make each day count.
You know, you don't really realize how much help they need. And it's like, you know, some things are easy for us, like technology, getting out the vacuum, going to the store. But for them, it's like, that's a whole day's worth work for them. And they have to go to sleep early because they did that. You know, or even cutting the grass or just walking out to get the mail and the trash out. So, yeah, like if I can definitely help somebody else's grandparents, because, you know, I would want somebody to help mine and I help mine. Like, I asked for her internet password, and she just gave me what her internet is called. And I said, no, I need your password for your internet. And she looks at me and like, Rose. I said, no. Oh, my God. So, yes, there's definitely, even with technology and helping her with her email and how to play games. Oh.
I'm grateful that she is so kind and understanding and willing to adapt to an older person that, you know, our point of views and things are very different, but we have a lot of similarities too. And I just think she's a beautiful person. I mean, you know, I'd be happy if she was in my family. So, and then I am grateful for pushing that vacuum cleaner that I can't do and I don't even want to do because it takes every bit of strength that I have in the world to get it across the room.
Well, I'm grateful for you because, you know, you just show me that getting old doesn't have to be so dull, and just looking at you makes me happy that I should be blessed to be where you're at.
She's gonna make me cry.
Stop. And you're just so sweet. You really are. Like, you're one of the best. You're definitely my top favorite. Definitely.
That was 20-year-old Cheyenne Harleman and 81-year-old Rosaline Eline. They were paired through Papa, a company that brings together older adults in need with younger adults who are happy to help. The Family On Demand service was founded in Miami in 2018, and since then, it's expanded to several other states. Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle spoke with Papa founder and CEO Andrew Parker about the service and how they've adapted to the pandemic.
What was your motivation behind Papa Pal's service?
So originally I started Papa to support my grandfather, who we call Papa. He wasn't needing home care, traditionally speaking, and he needed someone kind of here and there and was isolated and didn't have a car. And so I thought it would be more valuable to him and more impactful to connect him to a young, energetic college student. And at the time thought a nursing student would be valuable just in case something went astray. And we paired him with someone I found in the community, and he absolutely loved it. And so ever since that moment, we've been building Papa.
Wow. And so tell me about your Papa, and what was he like? How did he bond with this college student that you paired him with?
So my grandfather was an entrepreneur. He moved from Argentina to Miami just before my mother was born, and raised the family and grew the family here in South Florida. He was a very strong-willed older adult or grandfather, kind of the king of the family, and always inspired me to be an entrepreneur, you know, which is, of course, what I've become. And when he ultimately, unfortunately, got dementia, which progressed pretty rapidly into Alzheimer's, he needed a lot more assistance and support. And my grandmother, who was his primary caregiver, needed some respite. You know, she needed some help around the house with my grandfather, and she needed some support in addition to just herself managing the services. And so we had tried home care services, but he didn't really need it per se. And then he also felt like he was being cared for. And so he didn't want to feel like that. And so almost by pairing him with a young, fun, energetic, you know, what we call Papa Pal, it was something that made him feel excited and uplifting. And he was an artist. And so he would show her his sculptures. He made in the latter part of his life, like 60 or 70 different sculptures, you know, 10 of which I have in my house right now, that were incredibly beautiful. And the moments where he was cohesive and able to talk about it, he's very knowledgeable, and he loved passing on this information to the younger generation. So Papa was valuable for my grandfather Papa, but also for the pal whose name was Andrew. And we've just been trying to repeat that magical experience we first saw with my grandfather ever since.
And then with that, how has the pandemic impacted your business?
So Papa traditionally sends, you know, Papa Pals into the home of older adults and drives them and helps them and teaches them and other things. And because of COVID, obviously, we wanted to ensure social distance, especially in the older adult population. And so we quickly navigated it and built a platform that allowed for both virtual visits and in person. And it's been really powerful. And because of that, Papa members who are now more lonely and isolated than ever are able to connect with someone who's energetic and youthful and, you know, can provide that companionship and also provide what we call assistance from a distance. So if you need to go grocery shopping, and you're older and it's COVID, you may be scared to leave your house, or maybe it's not the best idea. A pal could go pick it up for you, wear a mask, and drop it off in a contactless fashion.
So who makes a good Papa Pal? What kind of characteristics or personality traits do you look for?
So really a youthful, energetic, trustworthy, engaging individual that is wanting to provide support to this population. And we've been very fortunate to have a lot of applicants. We have 20,000 plus people apply a month, but it's incredibly strict to become a Papa Pal. There's thorough vetting, background check, personality test, car inspection, DMV lookup, social media scan, training, among other things, including constantly monitoring. So we know what happens every visit. We know what happens every week. We know the tasks and the objectives that are complete if necessary. And we know how the member feels. We actually find out what they feel through a mood application that we've built into the platform to understand, are you sad? Are you happy? Are you disgruntled? Or are you neutral? And over time, we actually see the impact both from a reduction of loneliness, an improvement of unhealthy days, which is a CDC terminology, and overall state of mind. You know, mental health is in more of a light has been shined on mental health now because of COVID than ever before. And we don't want to forget about the seniors that really need our support now more than ever.
Right. And so these older adults and then the younger Papa Pals that get paired with them that might be college students or just younger, what do these two populations that are in such sometimes different places in life, what do they have in common? What do they find?
Well, so at the surface, what's interesting, according to a recent Cigna study, is the two loneliest generations are older adults and college age individuals, which is the general age population that we have as Papa Pals today. And the intergenerational bond is magical. And I think it really goes back to my papa's experience. He didn't want to feel that a caregiver is coming to help him, though he needed help. So we almost were in an incognito way able to improve the life of my grandfather, not just, you know, provide support to my grandmother and my mom that needed help. And so that was really powerful. We provide what we think of as true independence. If you're older and you can call a phone number or use an app if you're able to, or video chat or telephone, or wait for someone to show up, you know, it's really powerful. It makes you feel, you know, like you're a person, which you are. And so I think it's really important to not forget the part that companionship is our core. And then in terms of what do they talk about, the stories are endless. You know, we have a member like Sam. He's about 97 years old. He's been on many publications with me. He's really funny and he's lonely and he doesn't drive. And so the pal is essentially from his perspective, they drive him, they help him, they teach him. But he's also able to teach them. He was a Disney animatronic designer in like the 30s. And then he's had many interesting jobs, including in TV and production. And we've paired him with pals that are interns at Disney and want to have a corporate job at Disney in their future. Or a member we had that was on the Tour de France like a long time ago. We didn't know this until after. And we ended up pairing him with a Papa Pal, not that was on the Tour de France, but was kind of a cyclist enthusiast. And they had a really great experience.
That was Papa founder and CEO Andrew Parker speaking with Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle. The Grandkids On Demand service provides companionship and assistance for older adults. For more information about Papa, check our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Tuesday, December 1st. Thank you so much for listening to the program. Katie Switalski-Munoz will be guest hosting tomorrow. You can continue to show your support for this program during this winter membership campaign. It's easy to do online at WLRN.org.